Next case is Rose Schultz v. Department of Veterans Affairs, 063313. And when you're ready, Mr. Letts. Let's wait until people get settled. There was no pun intended when I said let's wait.
Not taken, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Oh, sir.
You left something?
The cat's claw.
Oh, wow.
A souvenir.
All right. An exhibit. Please proceed, Mr. Letts.
May it please the Court, my name is Jeff Letts, and I present the petition as Roseanne Schultz. This case presents three legal issues for the Court to consider today. The first, whether the failure to obey an order constitutes insubordination. The second, what constitutes a direct order. And the third, whether agreeing to perform an assignment negates the charge of failure to obey an order. Turning to the first issue, whether failure to obey an order constitutes insubordination. This Court in Reserves v. Navy held that failure to obey an order constituted insubordination. The court defined insubordination as a willful or intentional refusal to obey an authorized order. The respondent argues that Reserves was case-specific to the facts of that case. Under that theory of the case, sometimes the failure to obey an order is insubordination, and sometimes it isn't. The fact that the court talked about the specifics of that case does not render anything different to the conclusion that refusal to obey an order is insubordination.
But why do we...
Go ahead. It was pretty clear that she was told what to do and didn't do it. I mean, whether that was accompanied by the word order or not, she was told what to do multiple times and declined to do it.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that you look at the facts of that case and the close relationship they had. The petitioner was trying to dissuade Ms. Martin, the supervisor, from taking a course of action which she felt was the wrong course of action. They met three times, and the third time the petitioner agreed to do what she was asked to do. But the point is, there
wait,
was
wait,
with qualifications.
Yeah, only conditionally agreed. And in fact, when her conditions were refused, she said, well, it looks like we're at an impasse. And that was the direct quote.
No, Your Honor.
No?
No. The impasse comment came later that day after she was handed a proposed demotion at the meeting in the morning of June 13th. It ended without resolution. It was after she was handed the demotion, proposed demotion, she said it looks like we're at impasse.
But I don't understand. The AJ, as I recall, the AJ found that Martin had instructed your client to distribute the letters on those two dates. Are you here taking issue with that factual finding?
No, I'm here taking the legal conclusion. This respondent makes a significant distinction between failure to carry out instructions and failure to obey an order. Those two charges are not the same. If the Ms. Martin had said, I instruct you to issue these three letters, that is not an order. If you look at Joint Appendix 26 and 27, for the failure to obey instructions, the level of penalty is an admonishment to a reprimand, not one penny in financial fine. However, for the failure to obey an order, you've got a situation that goes from reprimand to removal. In this case, the petitioner was fined $11,000, over $11,000 for the rest of her career. It is respondent that makes that distinction in those two charges. If you look at the notice of proposed removal, which is at Joint Appendix 28, they say it's instruction. They don't call it an order. All right, the charge is failure to obey an order, but on 28, the narrative is failure to follow instructions. Ms. Martin's memo of June 13th talks about failure to follow instructions. Ms. Martin, her testimony said, it's not, I didn't give her an order, it's about failure to follow instructions.
Counsel, is the agency allowed to make up a charge, as long as it's in the interest or furtherance of service, that is not within the range of a penalties for stated offenses in the VA handbook?
Yes.
Can they can deviate from this. If they decided no peanut butter sandwiches on Tuesdays, and if that had some legitimate tie to service, they would be allowed to do that.
If it's not covered by the standard schedule, sure.
So why can't they similarly say there is an offense of failure to carry out a proper order which does not involve willfulness or intent?
I think Missouri's holds that it requires willfulness and intent.
Well, in Missouri's, the board found there was willfulness and intent, and then it sort of fell on its way up here. But that wasn't an appealed issue. As far as I can read the case, there was no appeal of whether or not this charge should involve willfulness. That was simply found below, and it came up here. And so we quote that language. But, I mean, it would have been a different situation if Missouri's had been on point with your case. Is intent required or not? And the board found, and we found it was. But that's not what was appealed in Missouri's. It was the penalty only that was appealed.
I would urge the court to take it into consideration because of the severity of the penalty. When we talk about the various charges under the failure to obey an
order. Did you appeal the severity of the penalty, though? That's the problem. I think if you had, you'd probably been in a better situation. But the government points out twice in their briefing that you've never appealed the penalty itself, because that's a different thing.
But that's, and the reason we did that, maybe a mistake, but is the charge itself, there was never an order issued. There was never an order issued. There was no doubt that the petitioner knew her boss wanted her to do something. There's absolutely no doubt that the judge, the administrative judge, has found that. We don't dispute that.
So are you saying you have to use the word order in the absence of the word order, then no one can require someone?
No, absolutely not. When you're going to charge somebody with failure to obey an order, then you do need to use the word order. That is our argument for you to consider here today, because you can lose your job if you don't do it. If the failure to obey instructions, which they wrote in the proposal notice and the memos and on testimony, that range of penalty is a...
But that's for failure. I see the difference in the range of penalties not between order or instruction, but between refusal and failure. The difference between the comparison that you're making between the two, and you say the first says instruction, the other says order. The first says failure, the second says refusal. In this case, this is a refusal, correct?
In either case, the job did not get done. I don't see that distinction. Whether you fail or refuse, it didn't get done. And in this case, like I said, there was no doubt what the boss wanted her to do, but she thought it was a bad idea. She thought it was bad management.
Thought it wasn't an order? She thought she wasn't really required to do it?
She did not think it was an order, no, Your Honor.
And what is an order? She didn't think it was an order, but she thought... Did she think she was required to do it?
She did not think so. She thought the matter was still in debate, which goes back to...
So when someone tells you to do something, it's not an order unless... You're not required to do it unless you use the word order in it?
I think that's the proper approach. And I think the reason is because you can lose your job over that. Under the failure to obey instructions, it's an admonishment to a reprimand under this agency's schedule. And on the other hand, the order is the fact that you can get fired. In Rosario's and Testament, they were fired. She was demoted for that. If you're going to use that, to me, and there are three reasons why you should use the word order. One is you need notice. The employee needs to know this is now a career decision. You can have disagreements all the time, but whether
she had adequate notice here is a question of fact with a high standard of review. It's not for us to say she didn't have notice.
Well, if you adopt our standard requiring the use of the word order, then it's an issue of law, Your Honor. And that's what I think would be the clarity. One is the notice issue. Were you advised that it was an order? These two, Ms. Martin and Ms. Rhodes, liked each other. They got along very well. They discussed other things. They disagreed. And they've always worked them out. I think when we talked about earlier, when she said, I guess we're at impasse after she received the demotion, to me, if anything, that shows her mindset that she thought they were still going to work it out, and they were at impasse if they hadn't worked it out. But if she had said that it was, in fact, an order, which might cost you your job, I think that makes it radically different. And that's what they didn't do in this case. Like I said, they wrote it up as though to carry out instructions, and testify that it was not about an order, it was about instructions. And there, in the agency's own chart, that's an admonishment to a reprimand. But the point is, they used the wrong charge. I think the respondent's brief covered it adequately and talked about you have to prove what you charge, not what the narrative is. And their narrative is something different than the charge. So if you look at, like I said, we talked about notice, the second is a chilling effect. How long can you disagree with your boss before you're going to get removed for failure to obey an order? And that's why notice comes in. And in this case, like I said, it was a professional disagreement. There was nothing in it from Ms. Schultz. She didn't think it was good management to give these three employees these letters. She thought it was unfair to the employees, and she was trying to talk her boss out of it. They went back and forth several times. And yet, the third occasion when it wasn't resolved, then she was hit with this notice of proposed to demote you. There was testimony in there, and it's from 43 to 46, about they've had problems in the past that takes over weeks to resolve. They've disagreed before. They liked each other. They got along very well.
So you would say she didn't refuse to distribute these things?
I would say that.
So why didn't she distribute them?
She thought it was bad management and unfair to the employees.
She was told to distribute them, she didn't distribute them, and you're saying she wasn't refusing.
I'm saying it had not been a final refusal, in my opinion, because she was not on notice she had been ordered, which was at the charge.
Okay, but what if it was refusal to follow instructions? Say I bought into your order versus instructions. Did she refuse to follow instructions?
I don't think so, but I would understand a finding on that count. Like I said, in her mind, the issue was still alive after the morning of June 13th. And that's why she talked about being at impasse later that day when she gets handed a notice. They have always worked things out. She thought it would be worked out.
Stating we're at an impasse doesn't sound like they're going to keep talking. Keeping talking, if one were going to do that, the comment would be, let's talk further. At an impasse sounds final.
Well, that's when she got to propose the motion. That was the message. And now it's in writing. We propose to demote you. That's why she came to that conclusion, Your Honor. I would agree with you. But you look at that, and you know there's a chilling effect of how long can you disagree? If you're not put on notice that this is now in order, then you know we could have a disagreement. I think the matter is still open. Well, tomorrow morning I get hit with a notice of proposed demotion. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's a basic notice requirement. They charged you with failure to obey an order, and an order was never, nobody ever used the word order. They've got a separate charge for failure to follow instructions, which has a radically different penalty. And because it's that willful and intent. The MSPB did not make a finding that it was willful and intentional, and if it's an adverse action for refusing to obey an order, I think that has to be in there.
I think we have your argument. It's getting circular. You want to save your rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
Mr. Wallach, welcome back.
Yes.
Hitting from both sides of the plate today.
Good practice. May it please the court, we ask that this court affirm the board's decision to vote Ms. Schultz for failing to issue the sick leave warning letters. And before I get to all of Mr. Letz's points, which we disagree with every one of them, I would just like to direct the court's attention to Joint Appendix page 10 in the administrative judge's findings and conclusions, where in discrediting completely Ms. Schultz's testimony before him, he stated that she knew exactly what Mrs. Martin wanted her to do. She was hiding behind nuance and fine points, and she simply refused to distribute the letters.
Right, so those findings, your argument, are even though there's another statement in the AJ's opinion saying intent isn't required, even if it is required, it's inherent in the findings of the administrative judge.
Yes, the AJ may have made these findings of fact despite himself considering his earlier statement, but they are still here. And as a matter of fact, it has been found and is supported by substantial evidence. Ms. Schultz did refuse intentionally.
Do you think the word refusal implies intent? I mean, because there is a difference, as Judge Prost pointed out on pages 26 and 27, of the range of penalties for stated offenses. And not only is there a difference between the word instruction and order, which may or may not have any meaning, but there's also something between failure and refusal. Now, in this case, they both say deliberate. So both of the ones on this page would seem to indicate intent. But I could see failure meaning you just didn't do it. I don't know, you got busy and so you didn't prioritize properly, so you failed to do something. Whereas refusal is, I'm not going to do it.
I think I don't particularly know the thought process that went into choosing the words in that particular table and what the agency was thinking as far as whether there was some sort of motivational aspect to the mm-hmm. choice of refuse versus simply fail. I think if you looked at a dictionary, what you just summarized, you'd find that distinction.
What was the charge in this case, though, exactly?
Failure to follow a direct order.
And so that could, at least the charge, as charged by the agency, could be without intent.
It would be our position that yes, it could be.
But the language, the specification below that was the name of the charge, failure to follow. But the language that followed that in the specification was quite clear, wasn't it, about her refusal to follow a supervisor's instruction.
To use the word refuse. However, the case law in this circuit is also pretty clear in that when there's a hierarchy when interpreting charge and specification, that is first look to the charge, and that is what the agency has to sustain, has to prove. If for some reason it's not clear, then you can go to the specification and fill in some blanks. But if the charge is sufficient, which in this case...
Well, frankly, it's my view that the specification is more helpful to the government's position than the name of the charge, but we can differ on that. What's your view of the word order? The argument made that until and unless the word order is used, the employee is not on notice. This is something for which penalty can derive.
I think it first would go against the general principle that the agency is permitted to be charged with enforcing a certain discipline within their employment ranks, and that there's a degree of flexibility incorporated in that.
Well, you use the word order in the title. I mean, the charge is failure to follow a proper order. So is it the agency's view that the word order and the word instruction are synonymous or interchangeable?
All due respect, is the court asking a different question? It is my understanding that the petitioner's argument was that at the time of issuing the order or instruction, if the supervisor doesn't tell their subordinate, I order you to do this, it is the agency is forever foreclosed from bringing or sustaining a charge of failure to follow an order, which seems to me to be a different proposition than whether the agency can use the word order in a charge or not.
Well, I think the underlying assumption in that argument that you have to use the word order is that there's a difference between an order, ordering someone to do it, and just telling someone to do it without using the specific term order.
As I think we mentioned in our briefs, the case law here at the board does not really address that question, and the agency's materials don't address that specific question either, but if there had to be a difference, since it is used in different places, an order might be something more along the lines of, you are ordered to perform a specific task that has an ultimate goal, and you expect that the employee will be able to get it done without any detailed instruction along the way. Whereas instructions might be something, well, let's take in the case.
But in this case, they didn't use the term order. Is that a problem?
When Ms. Martin instructed Mrs. Schultz, she said, I didn't order you?
Right.
No, I don't think that's a problem.
Why isn't it a problem?
It's very clear from the record that Ms. Martin made it abundantly clear that this was mandatory, this was expected of her.
So an order is mandatory, but instructions are not? That's what we're trying to figure out, the difference, because obviously the agency thinks there's a difference in the range of penalties that ought to apply. I mean, their handbook suggests as much. So we're trying to figure out that difference, and we're struggling because you used both words, one in the title, one in the specification, and what was it? How do we draw that line?
We're writing on a blank slate here. But to draw, I wouldn't draw the line at mandatoriness. I would probably draw the line at the degree of importance, perhaps, in the task. For example, in this case, Ms. Schultz was instructed to distribute the letters. And there's a number of ways.
Isn't the government's position that that instruction was mandatory? That she was mandated to do it?
She was ordered, in terms of the charge, to do it. And I can imagine there's a number of ways in an office setting that she might be able to do that. She could go to them and hand them physically to the people. She could put them in the inter-office mail. She could ask them to come and do this. And perhaps an instruction that would go along with that from the supervisor is, for example, don't put it in the inter-office mail. Deliver this by hand to the people. Sort of getting into the minutiae of how...
Yeah, but I'm having a problem, I think, similar to Judge Moore in terms of what you're saying here, because I think in this specification, they did refer to what the supervisor said to Ms. Schultz, in other words, the order, what you call the order, as an instruction.
Yes, they did.
So is it fair to say that, at least based on the record, notwithstanding your comments this morning, that the two were interchangeable, she was instructed to do something and she refused, that is the same as her failing to follow an order?
has to be a distinction, simply because they are different words. Order imports more seriousness, perhaps, than instructions, as reflected in the penalties, the table of penalties that the agency has published. But in the case of what the agency must prove, they're first bound to the charge, and which can be informed by the specification.
Anything further?
I would just like to briefly address the Mazaris case, in that the proposition that Mr. Schultz asserts that it stands for is not the proposition at issue in this case. Two different questions. The question in that case was, is the severity of the penalty imposed reasonable? Here, Ms. Schultz is asking that this court pretty much either, I would say, write new law, possibly extend the statement in the Mazaris case to require that every time an agency charges someone with order, automatically that becomes insubordination. Sort of giving a hop, step, and jump from away from the rule that you have to charge, you have to prove what's in the charge. Now, every time someone said, every agency official is going to have to understand that if they're going to charge order, now, we have to, what really means insubordination, so there's something else here. And it's a sea change from the law that has gone beforehand. Aside from that, and calling the court's attention to the administrative judge's findings that she did act intentionally, yes, that you affirm the board.
One never gets adverse points for not using up all your time. Thank you very much, Mr. Wolak. Mr. Letts has a little time.
Yes, Your Honor. When talking about Mazaris, it is, I want to make it clear that we are asking that the court adopt that it be willful and intentional when there's refusal to obey an order. We talked about the language and the differences, but I do not think it's new case law. I think it's affirming the language in Mazaris, and because of that willful and intentional, it goes back to the notice issue of that was in fact an order. And I would like to talk also about, when we talked about her state of mind, the judge on Joint Exhibit 7, Joint Appendix page 7, talks about there was no need to find that. We've talked already about the fact that when Ms. Schultz got the notice of proposal approval, her reaction was we're at impasse, which to me shows that she thought the issue was still alive and was shocked by it. She thought it was going to be resolved. But it comes down to when you talk about an order under the agency's penalty, because it can be removal, and in Mazaris it was a removal case, that they have to be on notice that in fact it was an order. I would also like to point out in the Phillips case, the Byer case, and the Mazaris case, the three cases that we've both been able to find dealing with this issue, in each case it was in writing. And in Phillips back in 1989 and in Mazaris in 2002, it stated that it was an order clearly. I'm not quite positive on Byer, but in all three of those cases, it was actually in writing. And the standard we're urging does not make it overly formalistic, but just that you say it's an order, and the purpose is because it's now a career decision if you don't do that, and if you don't do it today. And I think that's what's lacking in this case.
In those three cases, though, it was in writing, but it didn't say the word order. Like in Mazaris, they didn't use the word order.
Oh, it's my reading that they did, Judge.
Really?
Yes, and Phillips was definitely in writing. It was on February 20th, and you had till March 2nd to provide some receipts for a credit card issue. But my reading of Mazaris, it was not only in writing when it got to the ship, but the captain and the chief mate both said it's an order to the employee.
Oh, okay.
So I believe it was, and to me that would argue that the formality of the word order, that issue once again goes to notice. The one issue we haven't talked about is the agreement for the assignment on the morning of June 13th. When the charge is failure to obey an order, she was going to issue those letters. The fact she was going to state her personal opinion does not detract from the fact that she would have issued the letters. The charge is about failure to distribute those letters, and she was going to do that. You know, we could have gone into an issue of, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. We didn't get there, but to me, if you're going to charge failure to obey, then when she says, I will do that, but tell them I disagree, she still agreed to do that. on the morning of June 13th. And that doesn't, you know, that nullifies the charge. The charge might have been you wanted to do it while expressing your dissatisfaction, but the charge of failure to obey an order, to me, is nullified. Once you said, I will do that, but yeah, I'm going to tell them.
The charge didn't include June 13th. The charge was for her failure to do so on June 6th and June 8th. Do you dispute that she failed to do so on June 6th and June 8th?
She hadn't done it by the time those days finished, no, Your Honor.
So
but I think...
When given the instructions, she didn't comply.
She did not comply by the end of June 8th, no. But to me, it's disingenuous for the government to make with you on June 6th, June 8th, June 13th to talk about issuing the letters, have an agreement on June 13th, and then ignore June 13th when you write up the charges.
Well, they didn't have an agreement on June 13th. Their supervisors didn't say that's fine.
No, they didn't. They rejected that. They said that's unacceptable. But the point is that negates the charge of failing to obey an order when she was going to do it. And this gets into our issue of you know, was there a delay or a refusal? You know, she was going to do that way on June 13th. That's why they met on June 13th, to try to persuade her to do that. So when they met with her for the purpose of trying to persuade her, she says, yes, I'll do it, but I'm going to say no, you know, that's her decision. I mean, it was going to be her signature on that, and she thought it was a bad idea. If she's asked to testify, she's going to say, I had to. It didn't make any sense. So, like I said, she agreed to do it on June 13th. And that's why this failure to obey an order and this certainty of her refusal, well, she wasn't refusing. She was going to do it. Now, the respondent has argued it was conditional, and I understand that argument, but the point is, don't say you refused to obey an order when she agreed on the 13th. She would have done it.
Your time is up.
Oh, sorry.
It is an order to conclude this hearing. We'll take the case under advisement.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until this afternoon at 2 o'clock.